Welcome to Hidden Bridges from Beaver Sound, where we discuss with LSE academics their research on unexplored connections between issues, helping us better understand the problems we face. I'm Ellie, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Don Slater from the Department of Sociology, discussing the implications of light on social equality. So, as a professor of sociology, you look at the ramifications of light on equality, conceptions of class, and conceptions of race. I think to many people that will seem like quite a niche topic. So, how did you come about studying light?
Yeah, I started the Configuring Light research group about 8 years ago. And it's the last probably in the long line of engagements with basically technology and objects in everyday life. So I've worked on consumer culture. I've worked on a lot of digital culture and internet as it emerged into people's lives. And lighting just seemed another incredibly important kind of material in our world that simply hadn't been studied at all. So it also involves a lot of technology, and it's a technology that's going through its biggest revolution in about 130 years with LED and control systems and so on. So it's really a kind of almost unregarded, almost invisible kind of thing. Which is actually hugely important, totally ubiquitous, and changing in revolutionary ways at the moment.
So when you're discussing light, are you talking about it purely in an artificial sense or access to natural light?
No. I mean, the original idea certainly was to look at any form of light. The main distinction was when I started, people said, "Do you mean it philosophically?" And I said, "No, I mean light that you switch on the wall." It's a very common question to lighting. Normally, I mean, kind of naturally goes towards artificial lighting. A lot of our work is about nighttime design, how cities basically create night. So that does take us towards artificial light.
So how did your research Configuring Light start, and what's the objective of it?
The idea for Configuring Light came about when I was actually looking at the emergence of internet and mobile phones in Ghana, because I was working in villages which hadn't been electrified yet. And when I asked people about what might electricity mean to a village, they would say, "Oh, it's light." And the Ghanaian English word for electricity is actually light. When are the lights going to come? And the reason that came out in interviews, particularly with young people like teenagers, was light would make their village feel more like an urban place, which they'd all experienced. And they could have different ways of socializing with each other, and a whole different kind of lifestyle and way of being together could come about if they had light. And this seemed a really powerful message about how lighting is a kind of important backdrop or infrastructure to all social life. And I am a sociologist to my bones. So it was about how does this material kind of enter into the ways in which we deal with each other. So that grew into a project which was really about things like cities and urban environments. Cities all over the world are responsible for lighting. They usually look at this in a purely technical way. How do I use light so that cars don't bump into people or into each other? But there's this much more profound question about how light actually makes a difference, again, to how we interact with each other. So if you have a city with really intense lighting, a lot of people believe that the more light there is, the less insecurity people will feel, the less crime there'll be. This is completely untrue, but a lot of people believe that. So you get some parts of the population saying, "I want this street lit to within an inch of its life, so it looks like a prison yard." And you get other people, again, often teenagers, saying, "We want as little light here as possible, so we can have a quite different sort of interaction with each other."
So based on the different ambitions that city planners want out of light, how can that change perceptions of a specific place, and how does that create kind of geographic or even social boundaries between our kind of visual interpretations of these places?
As a sociologist looking at light, particularly in public spaces in the city, one of the things you're immediately struck by is that cities either look at light purely technically, that's to say, can we light bright enough to be compliant with standards and regulations and so on? And this stuff really drains any sense of the social out of lighting. Or they look at lighting purely in terms of place marketing and place branding. How do we make this place look atmospheric, or, you know, entice a lot of tourists into it? The crucial thing for our project is to look at the ways in which light is much more complex, again, how it enters into people's lives. And you can see a lot of that in terms of things like class, race, the ways in which light is used often unconsciously to map out different regions of the city. So a lot of our projects have been in social housing estates, and these are lit usually with incredibly, incredibly bright cold light, the bluish light that you get, with a high degree of what we call uniformity. That's to say, it's blasted across courtyards or walkways so that it obliterates all features. It just makes everything and everyone visible. And you get a clear sense that that is about the expectation that a social housing estate will be a place of public disorder. You're expecting trouble, or you're expecting to mainly want to just police that area. And it's a really obnoxious kind of attitude, especially when it's so taken for granted. You'll then see the same thing on a lot of streets. For example, again, we've done work places like suburban high immigrant areas around, let's say, Rome, or a city like Derby in the UK, where the high street, again, is lit as though you're expecting a riot. So again, the idea is that that place is coded as working class or migrant, as a place of incipient disorder, and so on. You then go to a place like Westminster, around the House of Parliament, or to a middle class residential area outside of the city, and you'll find really rather warm, orangey light at a much more human level, mounted, you know, kind of just above the people's heads, with a low degree of uniformity, let's say very atmospheric lighting, little lovely little puddles of light all over the place. Same kind of light in heritage centres or upmarket shopping malls. And again, it's a very clear coding of a place in terms of class, in terms of whether it's lit for surveillance or lit for atmosphere.
So alongside the codifying of location by class, I know some of your research looks at race and how it is completely kind of ignored and misunderstood in our conceptions of light, particularly in public areas. Do you think you could just discuss that?
There are some really, really much more hidden kind of codifications of the city, ways in which we look at cities and aren't even aware of what light is doing. Very few people listening to this probably will know of the idea of the color rendering index. And that is that different kinds of light will make different amount of color visible. So a lot of cities have what's called low pressure or high pressure sodium. And it's the kind of very orangey light that if you look at your hands in it, you just look like mud. Okay, you don't see any color. Whereas LEDs are increasingly able to render a full range of color. If you think about daylight, you can see, you know, that's what we assume is the gold standard. Right? You can see every color. What actually happens is that, for example, different skin color appears in different ways depending on the kind of color rendering index. This is a very technical kind of thing which actually literally materializes race on the street. One example is I had participated in a lighting installation in Derby, which was to show the city council, community activists, a whole range of people, what different lighting would do. And one of the things they showed was a particular bulb, it was called a halogen bulb, as it warms up, its color rendering index changes. So at first, it's that kind of sludgy look, and we all looked very much like just brown, okay? As it heated up, you got all the colors emerging, and people literally, in a mixed audience of Afro-Caribbean, etc., white, Asian people, as we stood next to each other, you could actually see skin color. And everyone just looked at each other and said, my God, maybe we should be thinking about this. Okay, maybe it has an impact on how we see strangers on the street and how we actually perceive each other, how people are racialized as citizens as they walk down the street. I've got no great prescription for what to do about it, but my God, it's a question that kind of ought to be asked. I should say also, there was a recent project of ours was in southern India, in Kerala. And I was walking down a street, we were doing some lighting analysis, and I'd suddenly realized although the lights were incredibly bright, I was finding it very difficult to recognize people as they walked towards me. And I realized, I mean, it's very simple, that the lights were standardized for Northern Caucasian skin, not for Indian people walking down the street. So it actually rendered them in a way that I couldn't actually, you know, recognize a face or identify a face as it came towards me. And we do know that one of the main influences on people's sense of comfort or security on a street, it's not about the brightness of light, but whether it's facial recognition,
right,
whether you can actually identify someone coming towards you. So again, this seemed to be a absolute kind of post-colonial take on the materiality of light and skin.
That's really interesting.
It was wild. It was, I mean, as the penny dropped, I was thinking, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It's, you know, those lights come from Philips, you know, in the Netherlands.
So because such a central part of your research is on educating people on the importance of light in our interpretation of place and class and race, do you think you could just emphasize for our audience why they should think of this subject as important?
God, I mean, there's so many reasons. No, there really are.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about light as something that is utterly ubiquitous, there's nothing we do that doesn't have some degree of light or dark in it. So light has got to be crucial.
Yeah.
It's like, where do you start with that kind of question? When I started configuring light, no one, including my colleagues, wanted to talk about it. Okay. And as I said before, lighting seemed to be just a purely technical matter. Okay, or a theatrical and design matter. Let's make the street beautiful. So it really split. And what was missing in between was the social. And then, you know, there were a lot of issues there. One was a kind of educational one. That's to say, you ask, and I do this all the time, you do an interview about light and all people will tell you about is whether it's light or dark, whether it's bright or dark. Mm. Whereas I'm saying there are all these different qualities to light, which are crucial to how we experience a public space. So a lot of it was education. How do you bring people in? You can't even have a politics of light until people actually perceive some of its qualities and are able to actually talk about how it might be impacting them. You had cities, particularly as, again, LED control systems, smart cities were developing, who felt they could take a very instrumental and managerial attitude towards this. So again, the important thing with lighting, as in all urban fabric, was how do you open this up politically? How do you find people within municipal governments who are actually willing to talk about why is a housing estate looking like this or a heritage center looking like that? You know, which also means opening up a kind of politics of responsibility to citizens as to, well, it's important that a social housing estate actually is a nice place to live and walk down the street for some obvious reasons, but also for some less obvious ones. One's value as a citizen partly comes from how one is treated, whether the bulbs are broken or not. We spend half our time telling cities, you know, I don't care about a really smart, really atmospheric lighting designs. Will you just fix the goddamn bulbs, you know, so people don't feel that they're living in a sink estate. There's a whole relations of citizenship around light, just like any other kind of infrastructure. If you look back to the history of cities, a lot of one's sense of oneself as a citizen built up around things like, did I get a water supply or a gas supply in the 1890s? Light is at that level now.
Right.
I think the other thing is about questions about kind of right to the city, access to the city. You move a light a few feet in one direction or another, and you can wipe out a whole population's access to the city. I'm doing a lot of work at the moment on old, for obvious reasons, old people and light. And again, you move a light away from a bus shelter, and all of a sudden people will not come into the city. They're afraid of falling over, they're afraid of people lurking in the dark, and so on. So yeah, I mean, this is really directly important to people. It's also about our sense of multicultural cities. That's to say, again, and a lighting designer is usually very clear about this. When, unlike an architect who just designs space as if it's a universal structure, lighting designers are saying, I'm actually thinking about why are people in this space and what are they trying to do here? And how is the light going to impact that? So they're very clear about, well, yeah, again, a teenager might be doing, want to do this here. An older person might want to do that. Where are the women with, you know, pushing prams and buggies? And, you know, how might the light have impacted whether they're there or not? What about the commuters or night workers as opposed to people who are here to have a meal out? Okay. All of those kinds of issues are about, you know, multiple dimensions of difference, inequality, and so on. At that level, light is not just a kind of design issue. How do you design for all this diversity in a multicultural city? It's also a way into understanding multiculturalism, and that's crucial to the project as well. By getting cities to look at light on a street and think about all these different trajectories, they're also thinking in much more concrete ways about what it means for a city to be multicultural, okay? So instead of pontificating about, oh, we're all about, you know, multicultural difference and all the rest of it, you actually have to rub your nose right up against the actual differences of people on the street when you're thinking about light.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm Ellie Reeves and my guest today has been Dr. Don Slater from the Department of Sociology. If you want to listen to our past episodes or keep up to date with our output, please follow us on Spotify.